You are listening to The Dystopian Republic, and I, Raul Guerrero, am your host. We begin today's story on the afternoon of October 15th, 1996. A house sat with its kind in a neighborhood populated by people who've seen better years, hanging a Bromelian flag for all to see, but nailing a yellow-crossed one to a wall in its garage. Jessie looked at herself as she repeatedly sprayed every part of her body with perfumes she bought by the bulk for cheap. Her hair was blonde like gold, her skin's ivory was pale, and her lips were full and coated in red lipstick, arousing her husband, Winthrop, into sneaking up on her by slapping her backside hard. Jessie playfully fought him until Flood Sr. and his wife Jonna jointly told them to knock that S the F off. Winthrop apologized and said he and his wife were playing, irking her into laughing out her reply that like hell she and his Nat Tail were. Flood politely told him and Jessie to get clean and ready with an annoyed tone, squinting at God for making him deal with a girl who won't shower willingly and guy who can't keep his hands to himself. Watching TV, Lee and her husband Charles saw a commercial for Bulbury, a fun place where adults can bowl for money, drink alcohol, eat burgers, and party hard. That was where Day, Jessie, Winthrop, Flood, Jonna, Jansen Jr., and his wife Harper were headed to extinguish their sorrow, for a new anniversary was upon them. Frightfully jolly by default, the parade celebrating Bromelia's independence from Mexico was made doubly so by it being the first since Gregorio Jr. was overthrown. The floats commemorated the lives lost during the Civil War by the municipality and promoted the companies established in the year after Bromelia became a democracy again. In a duplex pair's first quarter, Milburn, Rebecca, Merlin, Rochelle, Maxwell, Ridley, Monroe, and Riley watched the parade live, dressing in and making up Bromelia's black, white, stripes and star. It was a reminder of why being Bromelian was still something to be proud of, having the party at Bulbury on their minds. Meanwhile, Maya happily babysat Austin, Andre, Arlo, and Avery while Jansen Sr. watched over Alexa, Flood Jr., Clifford, and Sunshine with glee. Ivyville's sure recovery from the Civil War was slow. West Clemente fared worse than most municipalities, and Delgadopolis looked as if the conflict hadn't touched it, which was shocking given that the city was where one of its bloodiest battles took place. Bassy, instrumental hip-hop music boomed out of Bulbury as customers bowled, drank, munched, and got down on the dance floor. Employees counted money, cooked food, mixed drinks, patrolled the premises, got their DJ on, and cleaned spills and messes. Staring at the pins on Bowling Lane 14, Jonna and Jessie laughed at the gutterball Lee earned, betting that Flood Jr. and Clifford could do better. Harper told those girls to step aside so that she and Jansen Jr. can show what professionals could dish out, earning an 8 and 9, respectively. Flood Sr. and Winthrop were the next two to play, and they both got spares, turning a 3 and 7 into a pair of 10s. Charles was up to bowl, and Lee yelled at him to avenge her 0 and shut Jonna and Jessie's big mouths. He got ready to throw when the Palencia couples convened at Lane 15, ordering burgers, fries, and pitchers of India Pale Ale. Milburn was the first to notice Charles's strike and praised him for it, calling it the most perfect one he's ever seen. Rebecca and Lee partly stood from their seats and asked what their husbands were doing as the men introduced themselves while shaking hands. Ridley didn't like or trust the cunning smile Charles gave and Harper found the grin on Milburn's face to reek of malice and deceit. Rebecca and Lee rushed to stand inches behind their husbands, but traded looks that fought the other needed her pretty face punched in. Charles could see what brought Milburn and his entourage to Bulbury all over their clothes, and he didn't like it one bit. He commented that the Palencia couples looked like the characters from a clown's fantasy world if they in it went monochrome. Milburn begged his pardon, telling him to take that back if he wished to remain unharmed, and said he didn't care about fighting in public or getting put in jail. Before being able to respond, Charles noticed that the face paint on Rebecca had a thick, creamy quality that reminded him of whipped cream. He licked the tips of his right index and middle fingers, ran them across her right cheek, and tasted the paint, laughing at her for being too poor to afford actual makeup. Charles took the toothpick he was using out of his mouth and threw it at Rebecca, hitting her nose with its dulled up tip. Jansen, Harper, Flood, Jonna, Winthrop, Jesse, Merlin, Rochelle, Maxwell, Ridley, Monroe, and Riley knew what was coming. Charles found Rebecca charging at him and Milburn struggling to restrain her hilarious, smiling with crossed arms. Merlin saw the pointlessness of what his sister-in-law was doing, and Flood thought it'd be better to prove that he and his clan were superior than to yell it out until it became a fact. Rebecca was frenzied in calling Charles a bastard, son of a B-word, Protestant, F, fascist, scum, and worthless sack of S. The music was so loud that only the Palencia couples and Cavamingo Sans party could hear one another. Merlin and Rochelle begged Rebecca to control herself, while Harper and Jonna urged Charles to back away because the girl whose face he ran his fingers on was getting increasingly irrational with her aggression. That was when Milburn said what Flood had been thinking, saying that the Palencia couples challenged the Cavamingo Sans party to a bowling game. Rebecca eased her struggling as Charles and his group accepted the challenge, prompting Jansen and Merlin to pay Bulbury to set up a full 3-game match between lanes 14 and 15. And just like that, teams Palencia and Cavamingo Sans were on the scoreboards, and an employee's coin flip chose the family on lane 15 as first to bowl. That was when the food and drinks Milburn and his entourage ordered was served, evoking a jealousy in Jansen that pushed him to request the same order for him and his party. Rebecca declared herself first to play, against Maxwell and Ridley's wishes, but to the relief of Monroe and Riley. Milburn didn't mind waiting a bit while Merlin told his sister-in-law to knock herself out and those pins to hell. Rebecca said she'll strike gladly, demonstrating her bowling skill with a strike that looked effortless and made Charles nervous. Seeing Charles's unease, Jansen advised him to keep that in his head because they're battling an enemy, and Flood said any ounce of weakness shown will weaken him even more. Anticipating another strike, Winthrop waited for the second before Rebecca completed her throw, and when it came, he blew into under his left elbow as hard as he could. That created a loud fart noise that shattered her concentration, causing her to throw her ball into the left gutter and be warm red in the face. Rebecca walked up to Winthrop and gave him a stiff kick in the groin, winning herself a jab to the back of her neck by Jesse. As his wife fell on all fours, Milburn shoved Harper and Jonna to keep them from beating her while she was down. His attempt to tend to Rebecca was stopped by Jansen punching him in the left dimple, which Flood followed with a knee to the skullcap. That resulted in Merlin, Rochelle, Maxwell, Ridley, Monroe, and Riley rushing to help their hurt brother and sister. Their rush crashed onto Jansen, Harper, Flood, Jonna, Winthrop, Jesse, Charles, and Lee, ensuing a passionate brawl that got Bulbury's other guests to stop what they were doing and watch. The fight was met with chants for it not to stop or mellow out, and scared the manager into calling for security to intervene. It went on for 5 bloody, savage, deafening, and destructive minutes, and even the biggest and most seasoned officers couldn't break it up. The manager used the intercom to announce that the police will be called if the fight didn't end by her count of 5. That spooked the Palencia couples and Cava Mingo San's party into getting off and unhanding each other, beholding the horrified and disgusted looks they got from customers and employees alike. The manager screamed for the two groups to get their undemocratic a-holes the F out of her bowling alley and never come back. The Cavas, Mingos, and Sanzes waited for the Palencias to leave so that their exits could be made with calmness and order. Neither group looked at the other as they piled into vehicles and drove off without knowing that they'd meet again soon, and more so than they fought. For the couples and party, the rest of their Independence Day was spent cooling off and recovering from the fight at Bulbury. They slept through a madness that started at midnight, engulfing Delgadopolis the way Bromelia City would go berserk years later. In the Palencia Duplex's rightmost home, Monroe and Riley hastily got dressed due to believing that they overslept, as they were supposed to be on the road by sunrise. Charles and Lee had left the Cava Mingo San's home well before dawn, having time to sit and eat breakfast burritos in a diner that never closes. Rushing to Ivyville, Monroe's focus shifted from his driving to last night's fight and back to the trip at hand. The wild ride failed to keep Riley from remembering the moment she saw the lecherousness on Winthrop's face after he got on top of her over and over again. She thanked Maxwell and Monroe for getting him off of her, believing that she would have been violently violated had it not been for them. Eating French toast, Winthrop winced at each throb that zapped his penis and scrotum, recalling when Milburn kicked him below the belt like a soccer ball and said that kick was for Riley and Rebecca. He thanked heavens that Jansen and Charles saw that because their step-in saved him from being hospitalized or worse. The pain crippling Winthrop was made bearable by seeing Milburn and Rebecca have their faces bludgeoned and discolored by the bowling balls Jesse and Lee threw. He knew that a doctor's visit was unavoidable with one look into his briefs, seeing that his groin was bruised from head to pelvic skin. Winthrop wasn't worried about facing any charges related to his assault, as he saw the Palencia couples as not ones to accuse. Merlin and Maxwell tried having their ways with Harper and Jonna by force, while Rochelle and Ridley egged it on and held them down. Winthrop finished his oatmeal in time to help Jesse undress, step into the shower, rub warm water on her body, and lather it with soap. He could feel her fighting the fear that's telling her to run out like the scared little baby she was, tightening his grips on her hand and back at each outward lean, stagger, step, turn, or push. That shower was Jessie's first in 4 days, her latest multi-day stretch without bathing, and a reminder that the day she nearly drowned in the bathtub still haunted her. She never forgot the faces of the young soldiers who plugged her tubs drained shut with a shot put ball, body slammed her into the water, and held her under it as the shower kept spraying. One man in particular stuck out to Jessie because of him looking at her as if she was a rabid dog that had to be put down. She's told God time after time not to let her lay eyes on that guy again, otherwise she'll be serving life without parole for aggravated murder. Jessie had no idea that the man who led her tempted drowning was Flavio Jr., someone with many honors to his name and an equal number of mortal enemies. That brush with death created a phobia that stuck to her psyche tighter than a leech with a death wish. Winthrop kept his wife in the shower by repeatedly telling her that the animal who tried to drown her was gone and can't hurt her anymore. Those tells didn't cure her of her fear or even treat it, but did numb it until she was washed, rinsed, dried, and dressed up again. Jessie couldn't be happier to have her near weekly shower be over at last, intending to delay a repeat of that for as long as she can. That relief had Winthrop giving her a lip that fumed frustration out his nostrils, dreading the next time he's gonna have to help her shower from undress to redress. He loved Jessie to death, but started seeing the futility in getting her to conquer her fear, deciding to focus more on accommodating it. Dismally seated on the toilet with her head down and pants on, Harper was consumed by the prurience written all over Maxwell's teeth-grinding smile. Jonna paced around the backyard in a desperate yet futile effort to relegate the pleasure Merlin pursued at her expense to the back of her mind, finding little relief in working on her bell pepper garden. She put on a gas mask, panted thrice to make sure it was really on, and sprayed white teal fertilizer out of a tank on wheels and onto her fruit. Rochelle doused the weeds sprinkled all over the Palencia duplexes with an identically colored spray in a bottle, rotting them to brittle shades of brown on contact. Produced by Bruma Calco, the fertilizer and weed killer served their purposes with perfection, but incurred an overdue balance few knew existed. Charles drove Lee through West Clemente, desponding at the rot gnawing at a town where many of the Yellow Cross's official party members lived. They pulled up in front of Jansen Sr.'s house and were pleased to see it not be in complete shambles, even though worsening utility and structural problems bogged its survival in uncertainty. Charles was as glad as Lee was to see Jansen, but his pleasedness was genuine while hers wasn't fully so. That's when Sunshine ran to them and got herself picked up and hugged by both her parents, making Alexa, Flood Jr., and Clifford want their share of the affection, which they got, albeit at Slice's mere crust bits smaller. Charles thanked Jansen for babysitting his daughter, nephews, and niece, but Lee wasn't able to cease looking at the wall cracks and dirt sprinkled on the floor. While the home was less than clean, it was still standing firm and functioning fully, but appeared to be one major misfortune away from becoming flimsy and non-functional. Lee shoved her look around by appreciating her father's effort to keep his house as tidy and sanitary as possible, no matter the futility. Jansen tolerated the decreasingly fruitful effort to preserve his home's livability and spent his Independence Day drowning his grandkids in a creed disguised in fables and folklore. Lee asked Jansen if he's sure that he'll be alright by himself, making Charles curious if any of his father-in-law's buddies were anywhere near a walk away. Alexa told her mom and dad that she wants to go right now. A want Flood, Clifford, and Sunshine also had. Lee kissed Jansen goodbye, and she, Charles, their daughter, nephews, and niece were on their way, but not without realizing that their car was low on fuel. In Ivyville, Rebecca had Milburn be fast and not hasty in his pulling up to and parking on Maya's driveway. They ran out of their car and onto the front porch, rang the doorbell twice, and knocked on the door thrice, and heard Austin, Andre, Arlo, and Avery crying. Milburn demanded that Maya open the G-damn door, or he and Rebecca will kick it down, disbelieving that his mother would imprison his daughter, nephews, and niece like that. As that was happening, Lee and Charles took the kids they picked up to Myronbury's, then Donish Fair outlets to eat fast food and shop for clothes. They decided to refuel their car on the way back to Delgadopolis, as its fuel light had yet to come on. The outlets were to be closed down on October 21st to undergo an expansion that would turn it into a full-blown mall set to open in August 1997, courtesy of the Zancure Property Group. With her right foot, Rebecca felt something underneath the welcome mat and found a key to the house, as well as a note from Maya. The paper read that her mother-in-law was sorry for leaving their daughter, nephews, and niece unattended, but said she was forced to, as her supervisor called her in at 1 in the morning to work from 5 a.m. to 1 p.m. when her shift was originally supposed to start at 12 p.m. and end at 8 p.m. Rebecca told Milburn that his mom needs to quit that excuse for a job and find something more dignified, safer, and less tough. Her husband told her that Maya could do that, forfeit her pension, close her retirement account, retire early, and get less than what she put into SICKBE, forcing them, his brothers and sister-in-laws, to work to pay for her joblessness. Milburn curled his fingers into clenched hands that wanted to punch the wall, funneling that anger into taking the key and unlocking the door. Rebecca said she missed the joke, but not how selfishly entitled he sounded, telling him to step aside as she bumped into him, then stomped inside. Milburn found Avery staring out the living room window and sniveling about Grandma, leaving her like it was all she could think about. The hurt in her niece's voice touched Rebecca into assuring her that her aunt and uncle were here and that no one will take or hurt her. Avery looked back and ceased her crying as she was picked up and had her sadness tightly hugged away by Milburn. Rebecca ran into the kitchen, saw Andre playing with his bowl of chicken noodle soup, and told him that she and uncle had come to take him and his cousins home. Milburn carried Avery into the bathroom where Austin knelt before a bathtub drain as water showered her fully clothed being. She shakily turned to him and saw her cousin in his arms, filtering her jealousy through a plea for daddy to hug her pain away. Andre let Rebecca take his hand and lead him out of the kitchen without saying a word, but blinked a sigh and teeth grind at Arlo shivering. Milburn carried Austin and Avery as the girls were low-key in their fight for the long end of the stick that was his fondness. Rebecca tried to take Arlo by the hand, but he swatted it away like a fly, nudging Andre into giving him a big hug that he cried into. Milburn sat and strapped Austin and Avery onto the back booster seats, remaining with them by sitting in the driver's seat and waiting for Rebecca to come out with the boys. Rebecca cringed, felt her stomach do somersaults and nerves shake her voice. Andre, Arlo, and Rebecca came out as two boys holding their aunt's hand to the delight of Milburn, Austin, and Avery. Rebecca locked Maya's house, placed an envelope that had a letter she handwrote into the mailbox, and gave it a stern nod. She strapped Andre and Arlo onto the middle booster seats, became Milburn's passenger, and was annoyed to discover that their car was low on fuel. Rebecca knew that a refill in Rusalka was in order, as much as she detested that town for hiding that processing plant owned by Norlanuda Farms. Milburn told her not to utter the municipality or the business that was its largest employer, thinking of the horrors uncovered at those two places. Rusalka also had a cornucopia of gas station convenience stores spread within a 1 mile radius of where the North Shore and Delbrew highways intersected. Rebecca was sure their time in that town would be brief, and that she, Milburn, and the kids can get to their home, sweet homes, and continue living for free and getting what they want without having to earn it. A few hours at the outlets sufficed in leaving Charles, Lee, Sunshine, Alexa, Flood, and Clifford with stuffed bellies and bags jammed with clothes and toys. Rusalka was their next stop, and where they'll fill up the car at a price per gallon 20 to 25 cents lower than what the gas stations in Delgadopolis were charging. The radius was full of people pumping gas, buying food, consuming it, and getting their cars machine washed like the Independence Day holiday never happened. Gas stations and convenience stores from Bromelia and abroad called it their place to set up shop, looking to make the big money from the constant traffic and tight-knit locals. Milburn parked the car at pump number 11 of 18 at Gas and Food, Bromelia's largest chain of gas station food marts. He had Rebecca stay with the kids as he got to work, and didn't let the smell of pig dung distract him from doing what he set out to do to get home happy and satisfied. Milburn pulled a face at the gas and food sign and fuel pump nozzle he was pressing on, cracking his refusal to allow the stench to get to him. Charles parked at pump number 13, stepped out, halted, and stumbled, his knees bent at Milburn finishing filling his car up. He saw the Palencia cousins strapped inside, and so did Lee, who thought they'd make wonderful playmates for the kids they had in tow. Charles watched Milburn and Rebecca walk into the food mart and gave the Palencia cousins a smile submerged in malice. Austin, Andre, Arlo, and Avery didn't see him or Lee approaching them, thinking about how Maya broke her promise not to leave them. Milburn was deciding which six-pack of beer to get, and Rebecca filled two large cups with coffee for him and herself. Looking behind their shoulders, they saw Flavio Jr. and Manola enter the store, shaking the cashiers on duty into taking two or three steps back. Milburn took a six-pack without caring what the brand was, and Rebecca rushed, mixing sugar and cream into the coffees. This was right as the mid-afternoon rush befell on gas and food and other gas station convenience stores like an ocean wave. Rebecca and Manola gasped when they saw one another while Milburn and Flavio traded, handshook, and manly hugged their what-up mans and brothers. The radio left on entertained Sunshine, Alexa, Flood, and Clifford with children singing to friendly skeletons dancing to the full moon. Manola was so glad to see Rebecca again, and Flavio asked Milburn how he's been as Lee and Charles opened the door and said hello to the Palencia cousins. Avery waved back, and Andre grinned, but Austin widened her eyes in fear, and Arlo yelled "Stranger danger" and screamed at the top of his lungs. Rebecca and Milburn heard the scream, dropped the coffees and beer, and rushed out with Flavio and Manola following close behind. The Palencia cousins cried for help as Lee and Charles hastily unstrapped them and tried pulling them out, resisting with slaps and kicks as frenzied as the rates their hearts had soared to. Arlo yelled for Tio and Tia to help him and his primos like a madman, causing bursts of wailing to come out of Austin, Andre, and Avery. Rebecca furiously asked Charles and Lee what the F they were doing to their kids, which Milburn followed with an order for the cousins' would-be kidnappers to let the children go while they still had their freedom. In the midst of the rush, a fancy coach bus moved its way to pump number 16 like a slug, needing to block 17 and 18 to fill up. Charles and Lee grudgingly unhanded the cousins, fearing prison, but would become the ones doing the asking and ordering when Rebecca, Milburn, Flavio, and Manola charged for Alexa, Flood, Clifford, and Sunshine with childishly impious laughs. The Cavamingo Sans cousins heard the loud runs, saw the malicious looks, and got ready to be snatched by bad people. Rebecca, Milburn, Flavio, and Manola were stiffly tackled by six well-dressed students who turned out to be Candida, Catalito VI, Yamile, Regulo, Verinia, and Lisandro. Running their shoes on the asphalt, Lee and Charles halted in shocked relief, thanking the tacklers for the unexpected save. Rebecca, Milburn, Flavio, and Manola leapt back up and gathered in front of the Palencia car like a moving wall. Candida told Lee and Charles that she and her friends would gladly tackle any time if it meant saving innocent children from inner-city indoctrination. Chuckling his scowl, Milburn called her a spoiled, rotten little B-word and said it's time she and her clique learn an agonizing lesson. Lee yelled that four against eight meant that he, Rebecca, Flavio, and Manola get squashed and their guts smeared all around, prompting a teen girl to scream that she was mistaken and that the fight was a fair one. The next thing the Maroonberry Six knew, their rival clique formed their own moving wall, but in front of the Palencias and Carlos's. That second group consisted of Purdy, Hutton, Vivian, Meade, Bryn, and Emilio Andrade. And those six were the adopted children of Jacob, the founder, president, and CEO of Jacadrade Health. Milburn and Rebecca were grateful for the backup, as it proved that not everyone had a first for the Yellow Cross to rise again. Purdy responded that any enemy of fascism was an ally of hers and that of her brothers and sisters. Milburn grinned a nod, and Rebecca mouthed a thank you, but Lee grunted her irateness, and Charles stomped in outrage. Candida asked Purdy, Hutton, Vivian, Mead, Bryn, and Emilio where their daddy was with a laugh that got under their skin. Virinia said Jacob, or Mr. Andrade rather, was in Bermelby working 7 days a week for 12 hours at a time at least. Regulo thought it was a joke that Purdy and her siblings went on about their daddy being a hero who could only do right, calling it pathetic if he could be perfectly honest. Purdy's try to charge at him was stopped by Hutton, who told her that he wasn't worth getting arrested over. She relented and politely told him to get his hands off her, amusing Catalino into saying that the Andrades weren't so close after all. Purdy and Hutton stared at one another, then Yamile asked if those two had the hots for each other, laughing and high-fiving Candida, who praised her for the comment. Lisandro said he never thought about that, and now that he did, he called the Andrade kids incestuous, deviants, and sodomites. Purdy shivered with a cracked grimace as she gave him one of the more seething middle fingers she's ever given. Regulo asked if her aim was to flip him and his friends off to death, but his answer came in the form of nearing sirens, disarming everyone involved in the confrontation. 8 police cars raced past Gas and Food as 4, 3, and 1, then 8 cops and half a dozen vehicles pulled onto the gas station. That arrival spooked the confronters into trying to behave naturally as to not arouse suspicion so that officers could go about their breaks or lunches without fear of having to act on a trigger finer than a hair. Lee slipped her credit card in and out of Pump 13, allowing Charles to refuel their car and top it off for extra time on the road. That slip and refuel handed Milburn and Rebecca their chance to calmly leave with the Palencia cousins and for Flavio and Manola to do the same, staring daggers at their opposites from step into vehicle to turn left toward the intersection. Those stares were how they pointed at Lee, Charles, and their teen buddies menacingly without raising the cops' eyebrows. The officers noticed the departures, but not the looks on Milburn, Rebecca, Flavio, or Manola's faces, having no idea that a brawl was moments from breaking out or the attempted kidnappings that preceded it. Lee and Charles finished refueling, left Gas and Food, and rushed for home via an alternate route. That left the Maroonberry 6 and Andrade 6 to stare each other down some more, daring the opposite group to aggress. Candida said if Purdy or her siblings had any bravery and honor, they'd prove that they're the ones not to screw with, betting that they won't step up because they're scaredy cats at heart with spines as weak as gelatin. The bus driver told the two sextets to return to the bus or be left behind, calling the field trip from Maroonberry to Bermelia City and back a gift from Roy Sr. himself. Even though school was not to restart until August 1997, the school system set up by the Black Hornets remained in place, acquiring its yellow-jacketed equivalent after the Civil War. This created tension between the educators loyal to Roy and those whose loyalty was with Gregorio Jr., yielding results that were rather compromising. A lot of that came from what Roy wanted and the actions Sinclair took to balance honoring his wishes with quenching the thirst for revenge within his ranks and keeping the promises he made to the Yellow Crossers who played critical roles in the liberation of Lobotown. Then my Roanbury 6 stepped back onto the bus and took over two right-side seats toward the middle and glared at others into looking away. Candida said the Andrades were lucky to have the coppers save their a-holes today, but was sure that luck won't come the next time she and her friends are able to get their hands on them. The Andrade 6 entered the bus and sat in the two rows behind the driver, looked around, and then at one another in timid nervousness. They knew their ordeal with the Maroonberry 6 had begun, needing the best of 40 figures, honesty, and decency could earn, not to make sure they come out on top, but ensure that Candida and her friends don't. Milburn and Rebecca did agree with Charles and Lee on one thing, the fact that new mortal enemies had been found. For all the hate those couples had for one another and their respective loved ones, what they'd learn after returning home would push them to seek the other family out. And as fate would have it, that hatred will cause the Palencias and Cavamingo Sanzas to meet again and again with increasingly serious end results. And that was 1516. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the story I just gave. Share this show with everyone you know. Make sure they share it with everyone they know. Check out my website at www.rss.com/podcasts/The Dystopian Republic. Send me your respectful questions and constructive feedback at RaulGuerreroJr95@gmail.com. On that note, I'm Raul Guerrero, and come again for another gripping, thoughtful, and sinister episode of The Dystopian Republic.